hear a voice from the back of the room. I hear a voice cry out, you want something good? Well, come on a little closer, let me see your face. Yeah, come on a little closer by the front of the stage. I say, come on a little closer, I got something to say. Yeah, come on a little closer, I wanna see your face. You see, I met a devil named Buena Buena. And since I met the devil, I've been the same old low. And I feel alright now, I have to tell you. I think it's time for me to finally introduce you to the Buena 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 Buena. Good, good, good.
Hello, everyone. This is Chuck Clow from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation. Drummer Jerome Dupree played in The Humans, which toured with Squeeze and opened for legends like Iggy Pop and Patti Smith. He was also with Bourbon Princess, Joe Morris, The Coots, and the then jazz group Either Orchestra. In the late 1980s, he joined Mark Sandman and Dana Colley to form the great low-rock band Morphine and played on three of their albums, including Good, Cure for Pain, and The Night. He currently plays once again with Dana Colley and Jeremy Lyons with the fantastic band Vapors of Morphine. During our conversation, you'll hear us talk about a new documentary directed by Mark Schumann called Morphine, Journey of Dreams, which is an amazing behind-the-scenes look at the band and their story. You can find the movie on demand and also buy the DVD. Before I begin, I'd like to take a moment to tell you about Gaining Ground. Gaining Ground grows organic produce for hunger relief with help from an army of volunteers, and they give it away to people who need it for free. Throughout the harvest season, produce from Gaining Ground's farm goes to food pantries, meal programs, and shelters in Greater Boston and Eastern Massachusetts. Their approach is local and sustainable, and most of their produce is distributed within 20 miles of the farm and within 24 hours of harvest. To learn how to support Gaining Ground and for more information, please visit GainingGround.org. You just heard one of my favorite Morphine songs called Bueno, and a little later you'll hear a track from the Vapors of Morphine album, A New Low, called Renovo. So here is our conversation with Jerome, recorded at Woods Hill Table in Concord, Massachusetts.
Do you wear earplugs on stage?
Oh, yeah. I started drumming when I was six.
Oh, yeah, so
cumulative.
When I turned, I think in my early 40s, the right ear just started ringing.
Yeah, I got tinnitus and now, man.
Now
it's terrible.
I don't leave the house without 40 dB, just straight, no filters. You know, they sound horrible, but I'm just trying to stop as much sheer, you know, decibel level as I can.
I know it's terrible being just constantly hearing that buzz all the time.
Why do you think the right ear?
High ringing.
Maybe because of the cymbals and more activity on the right side of the kit. I mean, now they both ring. It's just that when it started, it was on the right side.
Well, the stuff you don't notice too is like the less obvious stuff when you're like at a football game or something, or you're in the big, huge crowd. The cheering, the decibels is unreal. It's not as like jarring, you know, right in your face sometimes.
There was one time we were at Fenway and just the general noise level, I was like.
So other than sensitivity, do you have a ringing? A constant ringing?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And there's no way to fix that stuff, is there? I've kind of looked into it to see if I can do something about it.
There are various theories out there. Jack DeJohnette claims he fixed his, but I don't know what he did or, you know.
He just cut his ears off like Van Gogh, and then you don't have to worry about it anymore.
That'll help with the echo.
Jerome, thanks for joining us. Excuse me. Sorry about that. That's our introductory music.
Cool.
Jonathan.
And you don't have your earplugs in, and now I've just destroyed your hearing.
Yeah.
I'm so sorry.
How's the tinnitus? Here you go.
Tinnitus? You can say tinnitus?
You can say it either way.
You could say, this tomato is amazing. I have tinnitus, but I'm going to eat the tomato. Or tomato is a delicious tinnitus.
You say tinnitus, and I say
tinnitus. The medical, it's tinnitus.
I don't believe you.
I'd say Google it, but that won't work.
Wasn't he a Roman emperor?
Google it.
tinnitus?
Just Google it.
So I saw you at Atwood's. That's when I kind of came up and introduced myself to you. It's a great room.
It's a great place.
Right. Really and nice. Sonically, you guys, I mean, you really full. I mean, especially with the, you know, with the baritone sax and
all the treatment.
And Jeremy and everything. Yeah, you guys sound, you sounded great. Is that, yeah, so that's a residency now. Are you still going back?
No, we're not doing it. We stopped in the new year. We're doing between one and two Saturdays a month.
Oh, okay.
And it's not constant as to which ones they are. So I don't think we have one until near the end of next month. But they also have national bands. I mean, they wanted the freedom to do other things on Saturdays. And we did too, because we're, you know, we went to Europe in November. And
that's right. You went to Europe. And then didn't you tour with to promote the documentary?
We did a few shows alongside the movie, but we never were able to, they were all one-offs. A really cool thing to work up would be to go on tour with the movie, but now that it's out, there's no point.
When you say with it, were you able to play?
Just after showing it.
Just after, okay.
Sometimes the next night, but oftentimes, you know, a couple hours afterwards, which we had done with Cure for Pain, the movie that's more about Mark.
Right.
But that just wasn't a good fit.
And when I heard that another documentary was coming out, I was like, another one? It's not many bands have one documentary, never mind two. So I was really interested to see, like, well, I mean, how are they going to approach this? And it's really a totally different movie.
Yeah.
I mean, the first one is about Mark and his childhood. And this one is really about the band and how it grew and the stories within the band. And I watched it last week, and it's a great movie.
It's amazing to see the growth and how sort of where the Treat Her Right band and the other bands sort of contribute with their feelers towards one vision. And to see that retrospectively is really fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it all makes sense now, it all makes sense in the mid-90s. But you don't know it when you're in it.
I met Mark when Treat Her Right started. I knew Billy and Jimmy from a band. I was in the Sex Execs, and Jim Fitting played harmonica in that band, and Billy Conway was a drummer in a band called Big 16. And they had all known each other. You know, Paul Coldry, bass player, various people had known each other in college. So I knew half the band, but David Champagne and Mark Sandman I'd never met. And I went to see him. I think the first time I saw him was at Swift's.
You saw it with Treat Her Right.
Treat Her Right. And I was a huge fan of that band. And then Mark started doing things with the orchestra, and, you know, as a guest vocalist. And I started playing in the Hypnosonics. So when Morphine started, I think I was the first person he called for a drummer. You know, he and Dana got together, and then they called me. So
didn't Medeski play in either orchestra too?
He was in the band when I was there.
Oh, he was in the band when you were there, too.
I was very lucky to get to record a record with him at Rudy Van Gelder's in New Jersey. Very hallowed ground for jazz musicians. And, of course, the whole time I was there, I couldn't think about where I was because I wouldn't have been able to play.
Yeah.
And then the second I got done, I was like, why didn't I think about where I was more? I was in Van Gelder's. It's like church. It's like amazing place. And I just blocked it out, you know.
Oh, well. So. At least you got to play there, so that's...
Yes, and it's a good record. We did... that's the third Either Orchestra record. We did a version of King Crimson's Red on it, which both...
He's on tour again.
Yep. Both Robert Fripp and Bill Bruford had said they'd heard the version and liked it. So that meant a lot to us, especially... I'm a huge fan. I went and saw the new band with the three drummers when they played in Boston. It's three drummers in the front and everybody else is behind.
Right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's excellent.
Really? Oh, that's right. It's right up your alley.
Yeah.
You're in the
front.
Are
they on a riser? The guys in the back?
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, they reverse the whole thing, but it's and the way they do three drummers is really good. They're not all playing the same time. Yeah. Some of the fills literally go across the stage.
Yeah, so cool.
Start with one guy, go to the middle, and end up at the other guy.
Of course,
really?
It's really good.
That's
and they're all very different players.
I mean, we're kind of jumping around here, but to that point, when you did the last album, was it Night?
The Night. Yeah.
You were playing with Billy Conway.
Yep.
You were both playing the drums at the same time.
Yep.
How did that work?
It worked great.
I mean, I know you guys are friends.
Oh, yeah.
And you know.
Yeah, I mean, I sort of talked about it in the movie. You know, they had been working on stuff and not getting it. Typically, you know, a lot of bands blame drummers when things don't
go
well. Yeah. You know, at some point they were playing at the Lizard Lounge, previewing new music, like unannounced. In fact, the picture on the back of the night is from one of those gigs with Billy Beard playing extra percussion.
At the Lizard Lounge?
Yeah, at the Lizard Lounge. But I went down and sat in. The rift at the time between Mark and I had been bridged somewhat. So I went down and sat in, and soon after that he asked me to come and play, and I did one day of just him and me, and it just didn't, I didn't like the way it felt at all.
Yeah, you wanted Billy there.
So I just said, I'm going to do it if Billy's, you know, we're both going to track this record. And we played it, you know, mostly live. I mean, there was some overdubbing, but a good deal of the basic tracks on that record are live, which I think makes a big difference. Cure for Pain was done that way.
How'd you work it out between, like, what were you going to play? Did you just kind of wing it when you were up there?
Yeah, yeah. There wasn't any rehearsing. I mean, as an example, so many ways I was warming up, just playing a pattern. I didn't have headphones on. Billy joined in, you know, like I said, we were just playing, and Mark suddenly like ran across the studio, put on his bass, put on headphones, started playing and singing into a mic. I couldn't even hear him. So it was just, okay, we better hang on this, you know. I mean, it speeds up a little bit, but the drums don't really change, you know, as the track goes on.
Huh.
So he sort of wrote this thing on the spot.
Yeah.
And for a long time, he had the drum performance. He wasn't sure what he was going to do on top of it.
And what track is that?
It's called So Many Ways.
Okay.
And was that at High and Dry? Is that,
yeah.
Is
what, yeah, the whole record was done at his loft. There were some overdubs. You know, John Medeski played on a couple things. They did that in New York. But and there were some string section things done. I don't know if they were done. They were probably done at High and Dry, but they weren't live. Take Me With You and I think Rope on Fire both have string stuff.
That place still exists? Is it the High and Dry?
The studio.
Into condos or something?
Yeah, it's a beautiful building. Whoever's living in that space.
It's a really cool space.
Yeah, it's
huge.
An incredible space. The view, when you drive by it, it doesn't look remarkable, but when you get up in it, you're above everything around you, and you've just, between the three sides of the loft, you've got everything from the Tobin and 93 all the way over to, like, looking out toward Route 2 and downtown. I mean, it's all there.
And it's one big windows. Brick walls, yeah. And is gorgeous, you know, like from the movie.
Eight, you know, like four windows on a side, I think, for three sides of the loft. So it's incredible. For the time that it existed, you know, it was really a nice space. And we managed to keep it, I think, for a year or maybe two after Mark passed. I can't remember exactly when it all went, but they moved it. They moved the studio over to the Armory Somerville.
That's
in the basement. And now that is still a studio space, but it's no longer Mark's gear. That's all sort of been finally scattered. For a long time, it was just this stuff, you know, that nobody didn't really want to just give it away or throw it away.
Right.
Didn't really want to put it on eBay.
Right.
So it was just this, you know, huge tape collection and, you know, his basses and all kinds of stuff.
That's a lot of old school recording stuff that is now kind of obsolete, I guess. But,
well, I don't know. It's still pretty cool. You know, he had an 8-track cassette.
It's in the movie. It's,
That's pretty wild format. I mean, it sounds much better than you would think.
I bet it does. And, you know, I don't mean to keep on harping on the documentary, but it was crazy because I was watching it, and all of a sudden, Mark Hamilton, I went to high school with him.
Right, yeah, he's from
Concord, right? Yep. And I had no idea he was involved. I mean, I wasn't friends with him, but I knew him, and I think he knows
who he's a character. You're gonna remember Mark, I think, whenever you meet him.
Well, he's always a nice guy.
Oh, yeah.
I was just watching the movie, and all of a sudden he appears. I'm like, oh, my God, he was involved with Morphine, and he was, like, a very big part of the movie.
He was the
too.
Tour manager.
Yeah, tour manager. In fact,
that blew my mind when I saw him.
In some of the only touring I've ever done on a bus, in fact, the first, in the spring of 99, as we were finishing up the night, they had a 2-week tour down to Florida and back booked. And so Mark invited me out as a special guest, you know, again, very spur of the moment. I think he asked me after Christmas to come out and play, you know, and, you know, we rehearsed once. We played a gig at the Middle East upstairs. And then, I flew to Chicago and, you know, Mark sort of said, oh, we'll go out and do a few songs and then bring you out. And that was the extent of any kind of planning.
Hmm.
And it just went great. So we did that again in the spring. And, Hamilton tour managed that whole stint. And that was the first time I'd ever been on a tour bus because I quit the band before they did, you know, all the major amount of touring.
Right.
So that and the couple of, you know, little bits that we did with Orchestra Morphine. You know, I mean, I've done touring, but not at that level.
Right.
So Orchestra Morphine, did that sort of meld into Vapors of Morphine? What's the connection there, if anything?
Members and then...
Yeah, it gets...
So what...
it gets kind of confusing. Orchestra Morphine was formed in the wake of Mark's death in order to play the music from the night. At the time, the record company said that they were going to support it. Turned out they didn't. So we booked some touring, and we weren't sure how it was going to go over. It was a 9-piece band, so trying to, you know, orchestra, make any money was really nuts. It was basically surviving members of Morphine plus the Hypnosonics, Mike Rivard on bass and Russ Gershon and Tom Halter on horns, two singers and keyboards. But everybody had a direct connection to Mark. So we did that. I think we did a month total. We did 2 weeks. I mean, we did a few gigs in the winter, just one-offs. You know, obviously rehearsing, and everybody was still emotionally really raw. So it didn't really get happening until we went on the road in May. The first 2 weeks were leading up to Memorial Day. And then we went out again at the end of June, I think. The record company didn't support the record, so it was just...
The night.
DreamWorks basically pulled the plug on it. And then there were some other things that just really took the wind out of our sails that are better off not talking about.
You know, what's interesting is the 9-piece band, the songs are great, but what kind of made for its character, and what Rolling Stone and Beat Magazine and all, when everything sort of came down that Morphine was unique, was this sense that there was a 3-piece that was doing something magical. And what's interesting is that you have this tribute band basically that's trying to emulate these very simple songs in a sense.
Yeah, although we played most of the music from the night. We played a couple of Hypnosonic songs.
Yeah.
We weren't really going out and playing the entire Morphine catalog.
Right. It was a way to memorialize with all of you guys.
Yeah, and you know, I remember in the, like, right after Mark died, you know, between his death and the funeral and the memorial concert later that month, so basically the whole month of July, people were getting together every night in different groups at somebody's house just to mourn and play music and whatever. And so it was sort of built out of that concept too, that let's come together. There was really no way that Billy and Dana and me and one or two other people were going to go out and make any music. It just made sense to bring in the Hypno guys.
Well, you're right. It's a mourning process, really.
And they had all played. I think there'd been other... I know Micro had played upright bass on a couple of things on the night.
But you know what I'm really intrigued by is the 3-piece, though. Is that not only is it the 3-piece, but it's the 2-string bass and a sax. People talk about this all the time. So as a drummer, take me through sort of how you fill the space.
It was pretty organic. I mean, Mark, you know, called me up and said he'd been fooling around. And he was always, you know, in True to Right, he played a guitar through an octaver.
Right.
So he was always thinking in different ways.
Low octave,
so it didn't, it somehow didn't surprise me. I knew Dana a little bit from Three Colors. So we'd met, but we didn't really know each other. But so Mark just called me up and said, you know, got this guy playing baritone sax and I've got this new instrument and, you know, want to play with a drummer. So I was like, okay. And we met up at my rehearsal space in Everett. Played, and I don't even know what we played on. I think there might have been an early version of Claire. Dana brought in something, and we just kind of jammed on various things, but it clearly worked. And then I remember we went upstairs. The rehearsal space was in the basement of this building. There was a deli on the first floor upstairs, and we went to lunch, and Mark, I remember him saying Morphine.
Oh, really?
He already had the name of the band.
Now, I thought I read that you kind of kept away from the cymbals.
Treat or Right, Billy used one very small cymbal.
He would stand up when he did that, right?
Yeah. Played a cocktail drum. Yeah, it was like one big tom-tom. When I played in the Hypnosonics, that was a band, you know, more funk, Mike Rivard playing bass, horn players, Mark playing guitar and keyboards, but everything based around very heavy funk grooves. Jay Hilt, the drummer before me, had a bass drum and a snare drum and then a little block of wood that he played instead of a ride cymbal or a hi-hat. And I'd seen them, you know, at the Plow, and I liked it. And Mark suddenly called me for a gig one night. He said, you know, Jay isn't available or whatever. Will you come down to the Plow and play with the Hypnosonics? And I said, sure. But I also knew Mark wasn't a fan of cymbals. So that night I literally took two drums. I took a bass drum and a snare drum down to the Plow, and it was a learning experience, no doubt.
To be that minimalistic.
Yeah. To you know, I mean, I found that without anything to play my right hand on to try and come up with a solid groove. I didn't have that kind of internal sense that you need. I was sort of dependent on my right hand doing something in order to create a flow. So to suddenly take that away was sort of like made everything feel kind of wobbly.
Did that help the next phase of morphine?
Oh, it definitely it was a great learning experience. You know, I remember the first time there was a gig really early on with Tudor Wright that Billy couldn't do, and it was not short notice. So I actually rehearsed with them, but that was like the first time I went over to Mark's apartment. You know, I just took a snare drum because we were just going to rehearse, and, you know, I had it all tuned up and sounding really nice, and the first thing David and Mark asked was if I could take the snares off. Yeah, and just use it as a tom-tom, and I was sort of like thinking to myself, you can't do that. It's a snare drum, you know. But of course I did it, and now I love it. I'll play, you know, most of the night without turning the snares on. You can learn a lot from other players.
I'm not a drummer. Right. From what I've seen of you play, you're not just that hi-hat snare guy. You're just kind of all over the place. And it's not, you have a very economy of motion too. Did the way you play change? Did it kind of push you in a different direction? Or is it just depending upon what you're playing, who you're playing with?
Boy, that's a really...
It's an awesome question.
It is. It's an awesome question.
Best I've ever
heard. You know, I mean, any musician, you play your personality, right? Keith Moon, when you met him, you knew he wasn't going to be like, fine, hi, how are you doing? Nice to meet you. My name's Keith. You kind of knew he was going to be an explosive personality. David Garibaldi from Tower of Power, when you meet him, he's exactly the way his playing is. He's very to the point. It's all right there. So, yeah, I'm a very verbose person, so I've always enjoyed playing a lot. I mean, obviously, I grew up British Invasion and everything, but when the Jimi Hendrix Experience landed, it just wiped everything else off the planet for me. Those first three records are just, I don't know where I would be if that music, you know.
Yeah.
And Mitch Mitchell was obviously a very busy, verbose, I guess, drummer, and he was a big influence. You know, later I got into Jim Gordon, the LA session drummer with Derek and the Dominoes and Joe Cocker and all that. Mm. And sometimes I think those two guys, in a way, are big influences in terms of, you know, I like to play a lot, but I like it to feel good. And I don't necessarily do stuff to be drumistic in and of its own.
Drumistic, I like that word.
You know, like a big flashy, you know, in the air tonight type
thing. I don't see you doing that Keith Moon thing at all.
Yeah,
you're just kind of just reaching out and.
Yeah, it's a lot of different textures and it's a lot of little commentary, but it's hopefully not drawing attention to itself for the sake of itself.
Well, that's what I was trying to get at too with the three piece, is that you're an integral member of the entire sound.
Right.
And so you can pick it apart and listen to your color and your accents, like you said, but it drives the machine. It's very full.
I remember Sebastian Steinberg, bass player from Soul Coughing, who used to live in the Boston area. When he came out to see the band, I was sort of like, you know, do you think I'm doing too much? And I remember him going, well, somebody's got to do something.
I like that. That's
and that kind of, I was like, okay, I guess I'm on the right track.
You know? What about jazz? So, I mean, do you?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I got into that later and sort of, you know, again, Mitch Mitchell was a big influence. You know, Third Stone from the Sun has a swing feel. There's a tune with brushes on the second Hendrix record. You know, I remember hearing something like Take Five because it was a hit single, you know, when I was really young. It didn't necessarily make me want to listen to a lot of jazz, but it was always sort of there. Charles Lloyd was another artist who kind of had a certain amount of crossover. In fact, one of my favorite drummers now, Jack DeJohnette, that was when I first heard him play, was on a record called Forest Flower. And there's kind of a, for lack of a better term, a Latin-y tune that I just remember hearing and thinking, that's a really cool way to play drums. Again, it didn't turn me into a jazz head, but later on in high school, you know, I listened to a big Allman Brothers fan. They had a certain amount of that. You know, rock and roll to me sort of started to go backwards. You know, Led Zeppelin had already set the bar so high. And then to me, where else are you going to go? So I got into Fusion, I got into Weather Report and Return to Forever and things like that, which then eventually led me back to, oh yeah, Tony Williams played on the Stanley Clarke album, but don't you know who Tony Williams is? No, you know, and then you go back and so then you get into all the classics. Yeah. You know, by the time I was out of high school, I had about a 2 or 3 week period where I was pretty much a hardcore jazz snob.
Only 2 weeks?
At some point you realize that, you know, I still like my Little Feat records and, you know, John Bonham and Elvin Jones are both really great drummers. And just because one is theoretically more complicated than the other doesn't mean what Bonham did is any less. I mean, look at his legend, you know. It still lives today. They're both. They will go down in drum history, both those guys.
I actually just posted recently, it was just the drum track of him doing...
Fool in the Rain.
Oh, God. Yeah. It's so... Really I could just... Cool. I listened to it over. And I got it years ago. I got it right when the internet came out, I heard it. And it blows you away. That rhythm is just so amazing.
A drummer friend of mine in L.A., I'd gone out for a vintage drum show, and a bunch of us went out to dinner the last night, and I was going to drive back to where my wife lives. And right as I was getting in the car, this guy goes, "Oh, you haven't heard this yet," you know, and hands me one. And I didn't even know what it was. I don't know if the CD was even marked. And I put it on in the car and listened to it all the way back, and was just like, because it's not just Fool in the Rain. It's
the whole album. Maybe it's bits and pieces.
Yeah, it's bits and pieces of stuff. It's all later.
You can hear Robert Plant like yelling and screaming and cursing in the background.
A little bit. Well, some of that's a little bit. Some of that's Bonzo. Some of that's The Fool in the Rain, where he's swearing at, you know, that he can't.
Right in the very beginning.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Counting it off and everything. So, yeah, that stuff is genius.
It is great.
I remember playing that for a bunch of people and sort of helped, you know, break it, at least in terms of a drummer forum I was on. I mean, I'm not trying to take credit, but just I remember getting home and telling a bunch of people online about it and helping spread the word, because, yeah, it's incredible.
But, you know, the Either Orchestra, did you get into Middle Eastern stuff with that band?
They did later.
Yeah,
I was in the first 4 or 5 years of the band, maybe first 3 records.
But you have some leanings now with Vapors of Morphine, right?
You're doing
a little bit of that right now.
Yeah, and again, you know, the Mark Sandman connection. Mark, he had these Ethiopian funk records from the 70s, but that's where Russ first heard it. I think I'm right on that. Certainly where I first heard it. Also, the Ganawa music from North Africa. The sintir that Mike Rivard plays in Club Delph occasionally, it's very much, you know, it's a one-stringed instrument. It's like a big wooden box with a head stretched over it. It's got this very bassy...
It's only boom. One string.
Yeah.
Makes the well, there might be a drone. Seem a little overkill.
There might be a drone. It might be more than one string, but it's a very simple instrument. And
yeah,
it
like
sounds,
a sitar. Right?
Yeah, the second he played it for me, you know. So yeah, a lot of that music came to us, you know, via Mark Sandman. But yeah, the Either Orchestra got into the Ethiopian music, and there's a CD collection, Ethiopeaks, I think it's called. It's up to like 20-some volumes, maybe more.
Oh, really?
The Ethiopian funk you're talking about.
Well, right? In the 70s, yeah, there were bands. I mean, all the Ethiopian music is sort of similar in a way. It runs on very similar scales. So in a way, there's a thread that runs through it, but the rhythm section and the way the music is delivered has been through changes over the years.
So, and you wonder about the sort of in different places in Africa, what there's got to be different styles.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
It's a huge place.
Drumming alone, just, you know, West Africa, there's hundreds of
and
different...
I don't think about the melody as much as I do about the rhythm with African music, since some of the influence of the African sounds.
There's a lot of melody in those drums.
Yeah, and the drums themselves.
Yeah, talking drums and
Have you heard that band Tiwarwin?
Yeah.
These are guys who are they from
Africa?
Yeah,
they're I believe they're Tuaregs. They're from
some of them
were
like freedom fighters or something like that, and they put together this band, and I remember I don't know how I found
There's also a guy named Bambino. He's a really good guitar player.
Do you experiment with that African beat ever?
A little bit. Yeah. I mean
the
polyrhythms where you've got 2 and 3 happening or 3 and 4 happening at the same time with a common downbeat, that can really mess. I mean, without getting too instructional about it, if you think 6 beats, you can hear it as 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 or 1 2 3 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 2 1 you've ever heard any Los Lobos, a lot of the traditional stuff they do is like that. And depending on which guitar part you focus on, the music can feel two completely different ways, depending on which pulse you sort of focus in on.
Now, do you write music?
No, I can help arrange and, mm-hmm. you know, I can maybe come up with a melody or something like that, but I've never tried. I mean, there are a couple things over the years, but nothing that I've ever been able to like document like this is mine.
I mean, maybe not like a full traditional verse chorus type of thing in melody, but do you come up with beats that sort of create grooves and songs that are inspired by that groove?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, it's part of my vocabulary. I don't necessarily focus in on it in that sense of being, you know, of using it to write. Mm-hmm. Sometimes when I'm playing, the overtones will suggest a melody. And so sometimes I'll come away from playing a beat singing a melody that I wasn't necessarily playing, but that I was hearing in the ringing of the cymbals and the overtones on the snare drum and stuff. But I've never taken the time to develop, say, okay, there's a bass line.
I also wanted to talk, I mean, we've kind of talked about like how your playing changed directions when you started playing with Morphine. I wonder if your playing changed at all because you had some, because your wrist issues, when you had your tendonitis, did you have to compensate for that at all?
Not really. The first thing was mixed connective tissue syndrome.
Was it like a carpal tunnel kind of thing?
No, it was more like a rheumatoidal condition. It was sort of like an arthritis, but more in my muscles than in my joints. But that was when I stopped playing for 9 months, and that was sort of the beginning of the end of me and Mark getting along. You know, when I came back from that, it wasn't the same. And, you know, when we started having disagreements, that was a scary period because I didn't know if I was ever going to play again.
Right.
But once I got treatment for that and was able to slowly come back, in a way, it's taken a toll. I don't think I'll ever play as, you know, sometimes when I see those early videos of the, especially pre, there's a video from Necco Place, probably one of the earliest Morphine videos, a really early gig. I'm just like slamming the drums in a way that I don't, well, part of it's taste. I don't care to anymore. Sure. But part of it is, yeah, there's a physicalness. Yeah. I mean, back then, I was climbing a lot. I was rock climbing and riding a mountain bike. So I was way more athletic than I am now.
But for the wrist, it's in both?
Oh, right now, yeah. It's like a tennis elbow. Yeah. Or even in some ways, I've got both. I've got tennis and golf elbow, and I don't play either sport. So. Yeah.
Right. Go they figure. Just call it that.
You know, as another friend of mine put it when I first, you know, the right hand went first, the elbow did. And I was like, oh, I got an overuse injury. And this buddy of mine goes, yeah, you're just old.
Yeah. Well, talk about overuse with drums. I mean, that's the occupational hazard. But
well, I was playing Vapors, or I think we were the members of Morphine, you know, Elastic Waistband. We were already playing it at Atwood's every Wednesday, and then I was still doing every Sunday at the Lizard Lounge with the Jeff Robinson Trio playing for Poetry. And I'd done both those gigs for a number of years. And then Jess Tardy, and this is not her fault, Jess Tardy called me for a series of gigs on Fridays. So I went from two steady gigs a week to three.
Yeah.
You know, brings to mind when you were back, was it the Plow you said, where you were not using your right hand?
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of just maybe coincidental.
It's ironic,
is that you almost didn't need to as much.
Well, yeah,
You compensated, but before you got your injury.
Right. Right. It's two different things in a way. It's, I mean, different styles. But yeah, you know, Mark's thing of just being, you know, no cymbals. I mean, you know, that Peter Gabriel record came out. I don't know if you guys are aware of that, but the third, 80s. Yeah, it was 1980, the third Melting Face, people call it. The third Peter Gabriel
Intruder,
record has no cymbals on the whole record. And I remember it came out. I was on the road with a band and, you know, we knew.
No hi-hat?
There might be a little bit on like one track. There might be a little bit of tambourine, but there's really no metal.
I'm going to have to hear that again.
I mean, Intruder is just.
It's incredible. Man.
But he discovered that whole thing. I guess, you know, it was the talkback mic. It was I think Phil Collins was playing drums
in
the studio. Right. And somebody hit the mic from the big room.
The talkback.
Which is, you know, horribly compressed. It's a single mic. It's way up in the corner of the room. It's got all kinds of compression on it. And Peter heard the drums coming over that and went. You know,
is that right?
I think it was either him or Phil.
Low tech, yeah.
You know, another more recent thing I can relate is Stanton Moore, the great drummer from New Orleans with Galactic. I saw him do a clinic.
I love Galactic.
He's a Stanton
band.
Yeah,
Chuck.
Great guy.
Yeah, I've heard him.
But he's got a line of signature cymbals. They're very extremely mellow. And he was doing a clinic and he was talking about them. And he said, you know, I've used these on everything I've done. I've done heavy metal records, you know, hard rock, all kinds of instances. No engineer has ever said, we need some brighter cymbals. He goes, you know who likes cymbals? Drummers like cymbals. Nobody else likes cymbals. And I had to say, yeah, you know.
That makes sense.
They take up a lot of space, you know, that the guitars like, and you know, it's everybody's fighting in a way for the same sonic. I mean, we have the same problem in Vapors, but it's all the low end, you know.
Fighting
now
for
that,
the low end. Yeah.
Well, you know, back in the day, I thought I had to tune the drums really low in order to match Mark and Dana, but you know, you couldn't hear them. they couldn't cut through. When now that I've started to do this again over the years, I'm tightening everything up. I'm playing with much more of almost a straight ahead jazz type sound because it cuts through. And I try to be careful with the cymbals. Jeremy's not a big fan, so I try to be aware of that.
You mentioned Galactic and thinking of New Orleans, and that's where Jeremy's from. Right?
He's not from there, but he lived there for a number of years.
Yep. That's sort of what his musical life is. Or do you have sort of that, some of that bayou, I should say?
Cajun? No, it's also pronounced bio.
Bioness?
Like tinnitus.
Like tinnitus. Tinnitus.
Tinnitus?
Tendinitis.
Bio. Oh, God.
Marcus Tinnitus?
You're going to hear from Jeremy on that one, I think, if that makes it to the
I'll give
edit.
Him $5 for the edit.
Do
you have some of that influence?
Maybe a little bit. I mean, New Orleans is the birthplace of that instrument, he says, gesturing toward the drum set. It's an American invention. Yes, it comes out of one of the darkest periods of our history, namely slavery. But, you know, the idea of putting the bass drum and the snare drum together, you know, first with one guy playing bass drum, you know, the brass bands, they were still separate instruments. But somebody said, oh, we can't afford to have two musicians. Is there a way to get one guy to do both things? So you create a pedal and put the bass drum down on the floor and play it with your foot and play the snare drum with your hands. And then somebody comes up with another contraption to play the cymbals and boom. You've got yourself the beginnings of a great instrument. It's, you know, turn of the century, so it's just a little over 100 years old.
Yeah.
And the amount of growth it's seen, both in terms of the instrument itself, the technology involved, and the playing is just ungodly.
Yeah, it's a relatively new instrument.
Yeah.
When you got together with Jeremy Lyons, you were kind of playing that kind of music, the New Orleans music with him, right?
Yeah, before
Vapors, right?
I met him at the Lizard Lounge. He had moved to town post-Katrina. Jeremy was just trying to get out and meet musicians. We started playing together and then started doing gigs with Dana, playing saxophone sort of along the lines of a bass, but before we were doing any morphine material.
Yeah.
That only came about when the 10th anniversary, you know, in 09, Dana got approached to go back to Palestrina where Mark passed, and there wasn't the budget to do the big band again. We had done, you know, Orchestra Morphine that next year in 2000. Dana wanted to do a trio, and because we were playing with Jeremy, it just kind of made sense. Yeah. So Jeremy strapped on the two string and
he sounds great. I mean, the vocals are great.
You know? No, and it fits. I mean, he knows how to play slide guitar, you know, all the blues stuff that we've done that, you know, we'll play a bunch of Morphine songs, but then he'll do one of his old country blues songs.
Yeah.
And it's never not gone over. You know, when we first did gigs, especially outside Boston, some of the early gigs with Cure for Pain, the movie, you really weren't sure if that stuff was going to fly with a basically Morphine audience.
You know, one of my favorite songs is the, I'm going to butcher this pronunciation, Renovo?
Renovo, yeah.
Hey, look at that.
Very good. Yeah,
is there a different way of saying it, Ron?
That's Renuvio.
I love that song.
That's another North African melody that we've sort of taken and done in our own way. It's originally got vocals, which is why we had Boubacar sing on it.
Yeah, you're kind of in the background, kind of ethereal, kind of singing there. Yeah, the first time I heard it was when I heard at Atwood's. I'm like, what is that song? It's a great song.
The CD that Chucky is talking about is...
Chucky.
Sorry, I just... Doctor, it was an endearing moment.
Dr. Chucky.
Vapors of Morphine, A New Low.
One last question. So you started playing some Morphine songs, and I noticed you do, was it the Cat song, Sheila?
Sheila, right? Yeah.
You kind of slow it down a little bit. So do you make a point of kind of changing it up a little bit when you're doing some Morphine songs for
We
yourselves?
Have now. Initially, we were doing them more verbatim. I mean, Jeremy was never, you know, going to try and sound like Mark.
That's
we
a
were
tough,
never
you know,
We
that's
were never trying to do it literally like verbatim. Cover, yeah. But it was 80-90% there. But lately, the more we've done them, I've sort of felt like, why bother? There's no point in being a tribute band.
Yeah.
You know, although we are the most authentic Morphine tribute
yeah,
band
so I would, if
on the planet. You know,
I would agree.
We have that mantle.
That.
You know, for a while, it was interesting to play those songs a lot because I never got to. You know, I recorded Cure for Pain and never toured it. I had played those songs leading up to it, but it was nowhere near the amount of time I've had to play them now. And I've been on both sides of it. You know, you have a song that you're really into and the drums do something really cool and you go to see the band and you're waiting and, you know, is the drummer going to play that same fill or not? And suddenly I'm on the other side of it going, yeah, do I have to try and play this the same way exactly every night? Which something like Buena, I never got to that. The performance that's on Cure for Pain is yeah. really pure. You know, that was not something that I had constructed ahead of time. That was purely just being in the zone. Huh. And managing to record it. It was actually a sound check. We had gone in to set up and get sounds. And Paul Coldry said, well, why don't you run one just so we can see, you know, how it sounds. And Mark kicked off Buena, and that was what we ended up with. I'm pretty sure that's the version that got used.
The version on the album is just a sound check?
Yeah. I mean,
that's,
I just, you know.
Awesome.
Yeah. For me, I'm especially proud because a lot of the stuff I pull off, sometimes, you know, guys who record, they know exactly what they're trying to create.
Yeah.
And every time you do a take, it's like, can I get every detail right?
Mm-hmm.
This was the exact opposite. This was like, I wasn't aware. I mean, yeah, I knew the tape was rolling, sure. but I wasn't concerned about it.
Yeah. I mean, we've talked a lot about this on this podcast too, is that there's that sort of risk benefit ratio of you have improv.
Right.
And you're going to have a creativity that's either, it's either going to go one way or the other. I don't know. I mean, these days if you can take chunks and then you can fake it a little bit and in Pro Tools or whatever, you know, recreate it.
Right.
But there's nothing like that risk that you take that is the payoff is amazing.
Yeah, no, I've grown up listening to a lot of improvised music. And, you know, a lot of those early, I mean, like the early Hendrix record, they probably recorded that in a couple of days.
Right.
Right. They said,
soup
here's a
nuts.
Song, let's go for
yeah,
it. And there's
you know,
a few takes.
And... Oh, and yeah, there's a horrible, you know, Mitch Mitchell makes a horrible mistake, quote unquote, right. at the end of Manic Depression. He totally misses the last chords he's still, you know, playing away, but didn't have time to do it again. You know
what they say, you make a mistake, do it again, it makes you look like you meant to do it.
You know,
right?
Yeah, but there are just things like that you'd never get away with now. I can't think of a modern band with the exception of Los Lobos that I even am aware of and listen to.
Is that your kind of your line? You want to kind of be more in the moment when you're on stage?
Yeah.
Nothing's really kind of set. You're kind of improvising a lot. It seemed to be a lot of improvisation.
We often don't. I mean, sometimes on the bigger shows, we'll have a set list, but a lot of times, certainly at Atwood's, we just go out and wing it. No, we're very much about improvisation and yeah, you live by the sword and you die by the sword. Sometimes there are moments where it's more like we're arguing than having a conversation, but...
What's next for you?
Well, we're going to New Orleans this coming weekend. There's talk of trying to go back to Europe in June. That's still in the planning stages. We'll be at Atwood's, you know, a couple of times a week.
Another album?
I don't know. That one took a long time.
How long
to
did
do.
This one take?
I want to say over a year at least. I mean, once we got rolling at the studio with Pete Weiss, it definitely moved along, but we had been recording stuff for way beyond that.
Well,
I'd like to do a live record. I mean, we've recorded a lot.
You should.
We've recorded a lot at Atwood's, and it's just a question of wading through it, which is sometimes the problem.
Yeah.
If I can relate another story, because this is just a great bit of history that I just found out. The Who apparently had recorded an entire U.S. tour to do a live record. Got back to England, looked at all the tape boxes and kind of went, you know, anyone want to start listening to this? Nope. So they booked two gigs and they said one of those was going to be the live record. First place they played, Leeds University.
Leeds, really?
And that's
live
where...
At Leeds.
Live at Leeds. So, and that is an amazing, one of the all-time great
yeah.
live records. What I want to know is, are those tapes still sitting in a vault somewhere?
Yeah, must be.
Sure.
And that's, you know,
be.
Pete, if you're listening to this, get on it, will
yeah.
you? I mean, I'll do it. I don't care. I'll sort through the stuff.
So that's what you'll be doing in the
Yeah,
next
that's what I'll
years?
Be doing. Yeah,
be
if I can get a hold
those.
Of Pete Townsend, I'll be... I'll be immersed in the Who U.S. tour from 1970.
He's listened to probably half of these podcasts, I don't know about this one. We'll see.
He won't stop calling me, as a matter of fact.
Right.
So, okay. So,
he's old school.
Anyway, vaporsofmorphine.com.
Yep.
And you also have Jerome Dupree.
Dupree.com. Yeah, you can write me an email there. Unfortunately, I used to look at people's websites and be like, it's never changing. Nothing's being updated. Trying to update it. Once again, it's like
it's
pulling teeth.
It's a constant battle, I know.
Yeah, I got to come down to Atwood soon. I've been there a few times. I love it, and I can't wait to hear you.
I know Vapors of Morphine, the calendar's always up to date.
Yeah, and we're...
You can see when you're playing at Atwood's.
I think we've got one or two dates in March. Keep your eyes peeled on their website, or call the club, or bug me on Facebook or whatever.
I can bug you.
Yeah.
Atwood's too is where that's where Duke Levine's gonna play.
Oh yeah.
Do you know him?
Oh yeah.
He's a sick guitar player. Oh my god.
He's one of the He and John Medeski are probably the two. I mean, there are others, obviously, but Duke and John are the two that I just feel so lucky that I've been able to say I can play with.
Yeah. So you brought your little set here. Can you play us some
sure.
something?
Yeah.
Jerome is such a prolific and great improvisational drummer. You should definitely check out Vapors of Morphine live, and you can see their schedule and purchase their music at vaporsofmorphine.com. You can also learn a bit more about Jerome at jeromedupree.com. Go to our own website at abovethebasement.com, where you can sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique. Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation is recorded at beautiful Woods Hill Table Restaurant in West Concord, Massachusetts. Woods Hill Table owns a farm in Bath, New Hampshire, where they raise their own meat. They offer a full raw bar and fresh fish caught off the coast of Massachusetts, and they even harvest their own maple syrup and honey for use in the restaurant. Local farms supply all their vegetables and grains, and Chef Charlie Foster uses international cooking techniques to create fantastic, seasonally focused cuisine. Go to woodshilltable.com for reservations or call 978-369-6300.